From news fatigue to chronic fatigue syndrome, this is the Perpetual Notion Machine for May 25th, 2017. On today's show, we are featuring an interview with Santa Fe, New Mexico-based author Julie Raymeyer. Her new book is titled Through the Shadowlands, A Science Writer's Odyssey into an Illness That Science Doesn't Understand. It tells the story of her personal struggle with chronic fatigue syndrome, which she attributes to exposure to toxic mold in her former home. When her doctors were of no help, she took matters into her own hands and set off to go camping in Death Valley to escape the mold. Our reporter, Lincoln Tice, reached Julie Raymeyer by phone to hear her story.
First of all, thank you so much, Julie, for coming on to the Perpetual Notion Machine. How are you doing
today?
Glad
to be here. I'm doing great. Very glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks again. So, you were diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome in, was it 2006?
Yes.
So what happened to you that led to this that led up to this diagnosis?
So I first started getting sick some years before that, and initially it was gradual. It was just I was exhausted all the time. It was like something's not quite right here. But it was a very, very stressful time for me in a lot of ways. I was working extremely hard. I was actually building my own house with my own hands, and my husband at the time was quite ill. So I just figured, okay, I'm overworked, I'm overstressed, I'll, you know, get my life together and everything will be fine. But it wasn't fine. I continued to have particularly problems with exercise, which were very strange. I loved exercise, had always loved exercise. But after I started getting sick, exercise just didn't feel good, and I felt much worse the day after I exercised, which was very strange. And in retrospect, that was the really alarming thing. And then in 2006, I woke up one morning, and I couldn't walk. I was semi-paralyzed. It wasn't just that I was too tired. It was like the nerve signals weren't making it down to my legs, and it was completely terrifying. So at that point, I went to a neurologist because it seemed like, okay, this seems like it's a neurological problem. And I was wondering if it was, you know, multiple sclerosis or Lou Gehrig's disease or something like that. And the neurologist diagnosed me with chronic fatigue syndrome. But for him, it was clear that what that diagnosis meant was, please get out of my office. I have nothing to offer you. He had no tests, no treatments, no other doctors, no nothing. And it was a shocking experience.
Wow, that sounds completely terrifying. First of all, how did you get into the neurologist's office if you couldn't walk?
That's a good question. So I could kind of stagger, but it was incredibly, incredibly hard. And if I had been more savvy, I would have asked for a wheelchair. Like, that was the intelligent thing to do. But I was not quite tuned into that possibility then. So I staggered, but it was incredibly exhausting. And when I staggered like that, I couldn't do it without groaning. And so I was this just like huge spectacle. It was quite embarrassing.
Oh, well, I don't think you have to worry about being embarrassed at that point. I mean,
yeah, well, that was, the embarrassment was kind of the least of my problems at
yeah.
that moment. It's true.
Yeah, so is it that chronic fatigue syndrome is not well understood by the medical community? Do you think that's why your doctor was so dismissive of you?
It's not well understood at all, and there are a lot of different reasons for that. A big part of it is that we're not spending very much money researching it, and so we have not figured out much about fundamentally what's going on physiologically in the bodies of patients with this illness. We've spent $5 million a year on research funding for chronic fatigue syndrome. It affects 1 million Americans. So that's $5 a patient, which is basically nothing. You know, by contrast, multiple sclerosis, which is similarly devastating, gets about $300 per patient, which is a far more typical amount for a disease that's that serious. So we don't know very much about it, and doctors aren't very well educated either. So I think doctors get frustrated because they feel like they don't really have anything to offer, and they don't like feeling like they have nothing to offer. The irony is there's actually quite a bit that primary care physicians can do that would be helpful to chronic fatigue syndrome patients, but they haven't been educated about it, and they don't know what they can offer.
Huh. So what would you recommend that physicians offer, and how could they educate themselves better?
Yeah, so good. Those are good questions. The biggest thing that they could offer is just giving patients advice to not overdo it. At early stages of the illness, that's really the most important thing to learn. Like the first moment when you have chronic fatigue syndrome, the first moment you think, I'm a little tired, you need to stop then. And if you don't, you're actually making things worse.
So you need to stop exercising and get some rest.
Yeah, or if it's, yes, or even if it's not exercise, even if it's, you know, you're washing your dishes and you think, I'm a little tired, those dishes are just going to have to wait because you need to rest. And the thing is that that's actually the way to maximize the amount that you're able to do. So it feels like you're being a lazy loser if you stop and rest at that point. But really, that's what you need to do in order to do as over the long run to be able to do as much as you're capable of.
So it can actually be harmful to be exercising when you have chronic fatigue syndrome.
That's exactly right. It makes it worse. It makes it worse if you go beyond your limits. And the thing is that I think that has a really big impact on how serious the disease develops. You know, I think people who are savvy about resting as they need to early on have a much better chance of recovery. So that's the first thing. There's also, there are also more direct treatments that doctors can give. Chronic fatigue syndrome patients typically have a liter less blood than healthy people do. And this is not a very well-known fact, but it's been documented. And the result of that is when...
Can you say that again? I'm sorry. They typically have a...
Yeah, sure. They have about a liter less blood than healthy people do.
Oh, wow.
We just actually have less blood in our bodies. It's kind of astonishing. The result of that is that when chronic fatigue syndrome patients stand up, their bodies can't get blood up to the brain. And so their blood pressure drops and their heart rate climbs as their body tries to make up for this. So, and that's a big part of why patients feel so terrible when they stand up or even sit up. And that's something that doctors can test for right in their office. I mean, just have patients lie down and take their blood pressure and heart rate and then have them stand up totally still and take it over the course of a half an hour, take the blood pressure and heart rate a bunch of times. And there are treatments for this, both the simplest thing is just electrolytes, but there are also some medications that make a difference, a variety of medications that make a difference. So this is something any primary care physician can do right in their office and can really improve quality of life for patients.
Very interesting. I was thinking hydration, but you're saying electrolytes.
Well, hydration,
that's kind of related, huh?
So, yeah. So by electrolytes, what I mean is something like Gatorade, where it's liquid plus salt and magnesium and potassium and other electrolytes, because those increase blood volume. So if you just drink water, then your body will, you know, your kidneys will just pull it right out of you and you'll just pee it out. But if you drink water with electrolytes in it, then your body will hold on to the water and it'll increase your blood volume, and that will make patients feel a lot better.
Well, that seems quite practical. Thanks.
Yeah. I wish every primary care physician in the country knew that. Like, it makes such a big difference for patients, and like, they should know it.
Yeah. Do you think that is there increasing awareness about chronic fatigue syndrome? Do you think that it will be spreading within the medical community?
Well, things are starting to change. We've got a long way to go, but things are starting to change, and that's wonderful to see. There are sort of interrelated problems that have formed a kind of like Gordian knot that has kept the situation for patients really bad. So there's the lack of research funding. There's the lack of clinical education. There's a lack of good journalism about the illness, and you know, the result of that is that people believe that it's all in your head or not a real illness or whatever. And all those things kind of feed on each other. So things have started to change. There's some really good journalists who have gotten interested in the disease and made a really big difference. Some of the an additional problem has been that there's been some really bad research that is just scientifically flawed and has increased this notion that it's fundamentally a psychological illness. And I have actually done a lot of writing about that, taking that down. And there's another journalist, David Tuller, who's done a lot of writing about that and really exposed the scientific flaws in that trial. That has been a huge thing. The NIH has finally gotten interested in the disease and has increased research funding. It's still way smaller than it needs to be, but it's around $13 million going forward, which is a big improvement over five, but it's still chump change. But it's moving in the right direction. Some very, very serious researchers have gotten interested in the disease. And, you know, I hope my book will have an impact on public understanding of it as well.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm looking forward to reading your book, Through the Shadowlands.
Thanks.
So is chronic fatigue syndrome increasing in its diagnoses?
We have no idea because the research isn't being done. It's not being tracked. We really need, you know, prevalence studies to find out more about that and about, like, you know, where it's a more serious problem and where it's a less serious problem, and none of that work has been done.
Okay, and I understand chronic fatigue syndrome is also called ME. What does that stand for, and how is that word pronounced?
Yes, it's quite a mouthful. It's myalgic encephalomyelitis, which means, so myalgia is muscle pain, and encephalo is brain. Myel is spinal cord, and itis is inflammation. So it's basically painful inflammation of the brain and spinal cord. And that's the name that's used internationally. And federal agencies have started calling it ME-CFS, that, which is the name that I have settled on. Sometimes ME is reserved for the more serious forms of the illness. But it's a much better name than chronic fatigue syndrome. I mean, chronic fatigue syndrome, for one thing, is just misleading. The severe forms of the illness, I think most people find that neurological or gut symptoms are more serious than fatigue anyway. So it makes it sound like it's just being tired and dragged out like healthy people get sometimes, and it's just not at all. I mean, it's a totally, totally misleading sense of what this illness is.
Got it. So you came to believe that your chronic fatigue syndrome was actually caused by mold in your home in Berkeley. Is that correct?
So, yes. What happened was I got incredibly sick. I got so sick I often couldn't turn over in bed, and I was bedbound about half the time, and had run through kind of all the medical treatments that were available. I'd been to top specialists for it, and it was a terribly frightening time with no real prospects to get better. And at that point, I heard about this idea that mold was at the center of the illness for some patients, and that by taking extreme measures to avoid it, some patients had gotten dramatically better. And when I first heard about this, I thought it sounded like pseudoscientific hokum. You know, I was totally skeptical. I'm a science writer, and what I knew of the science was that mold could cause respiratory problems like allergies or asthma, but it couldn't, you know, cripple you. It couldn't paralyze you. So I was super skeptical, but at the same time, like, I was out of reasonable ideas. So unreasonable ideas were the only things left. So I was desperate enough to pursue it. And I followed the advice of patients on the internet who had improved using these methods. And I went to the desert for 2 weeks with none of my own belongings. These patients told me that my own stuff might all be contaminated with mold. And their prediction was that I might or might not feel better while I was in the desert, but when I came home, I would react really strongly to my own stuff. And that would tell me that mold was my problem, and by taking extreme steps to avoid it, then I would get better. So I did this, and indeed, when I came home, 30 seconds in my own home was enough to cripple me. It was just completely astonishing. And then I stayed out of my home and away from my stuff, And a week later, I had a moment and I was feeling relatively good, and I decided to try taking my dog for a little walk, figuring, you know, I wouldn't be able to do much, but feel good to stretch my legs. Well, I ended up walking to the top of the 350-foot hill behind my house. It was completely astonishing. And I took a picture of the view from there. I live in Santa Fe, and so the view was of the whole Rio Grande Valley. I took a picture of it, and I sent it to all my friends with the subject line, "Oh, my God." I was just blown away.
Yeah, wow, good for you. So you basically packed up and you were camping in Death Valley, is that right?
Yeah, I spent 2 weeks in Death Valley as part of this experiment to figure out if mold was my problem.
Cool. So here in Madison, Wisconsin, we do have a fair amount of mold. I have it in my house, and it's because we have so much water here. You know, we're surrounded by lakes, and my basement includes the water table. So basically,
oh wow.
So what would you recommend people who think they might have mold infections do here in Madison, where we don't exactly have any deserts nearby that we could just go camping in?
Right. So my advice depends a lot on your particular situation. So if you have some mold in your house and you're fundamentally healthy, then you can take reasonable steps to get rid of it, and you'll probably be fine. So the only way to really get rid of mold is to actually remove it. So if you've got mold on drywall, say, you've got to remove that drywall and replace it. Just wiping it down with bleach is not enough. But you don't need to take really extreme measures beyond that. Just get rid of the mold and go on with your life. And, you know, if you're healthy and you're not too worried about it, you can try wiping it down with bleach and making sure you get rid of the water source, and maybe that'll be fine, too. If you're sick, it's another story entirely. So certainly starting with reasonable steps makes sense, but that may not be enough to actually make you feel better. And we really need research on this to come up with reasonable treatments, because you know, what I did in going to the desert, and then I ended up having to get rid of practically everything I owned, very nearly everything I owned. Like, this is not a reasonable thing to ask patients to do. Like, many people can't do it at all. I was lucky that I could pull it off. You know, if you've got children and aging parents and responsibilities and a whole life in Madison, like, you can't go move to the desert. And so it's an extremely hard problem. And, you know, I wish I had better advice for people. And it's really a kind of, you just have to do an analysis for yourself of how much you can do and what you think makes sense for you. The best kind of knowledge about this at this point is really in the patient community. So I would recommend, you know, turning to some of those resources.
Yeah, so is that why you actually moved from Berkeley to Santa Fe?
It actually isn't. It was kind of, in a certain sense, I got lucky. So I was from Santa Fe anyway, and I was living in California when I got really sick. And I moved home just because I wanted to be home. And then it was after I moved home that I figured out that mold was the problem. When I moved back to Santa Fe, I actually moved into a pair of travel trailers on my land, which I had originally lived in while building my house. And my trailers were somewhat moldy. They're not horrendously so, but definitely somewhat moldy. And that's where I was living when I figured out that mold was the problem. So I was able to move out of my trailers and back into my house. I had the amazing good fortune that my house tenant broke her lease and left right at that moment. And my house, it turned out, was really good for me. It was mold-free. So that provided a place for me to heal. And Santa Fe has you know, pretty good air, outdoor air, you know, relatively mold-free outdoor air. So it was a really good place for me to heal. But that was a huge stroke of good fortune.
Cool. So I've had mold, as I was saying, in my house, which is one of the reasons I was very interested in interviewing you. You know, when I got an email about your book, So I'm actually getting some testing done. Well, I got testing done yesterday, so I haven't gotten the results back, but I'll be interested to get the results on that. They took an air test in my basement and outside the house. And then I'm actually going to get some basement work done, some drain tile installed, new sump pump, ventilation.
Sounds like a lot of good steps to take.
Yeah, and then like a treatment. I think it's a pretty natural treatment to kill the mold. And then we'll get testing done again and, you know, see how that worked. But I wish I had, you know, the information to talk to you about, you know, the testing and what mold they may have found.
Well, I can tell you the most dangerous mold is called Stachybotrys chartarum, or Stachy for short. And if you have Stachy in your house, then you need to worry. Stachy is a really quite toxic mold. There are other kinds of mold that are also toxic, but not quite as bad, like Aspergillus, for example. But if you don't have Stachy, then
the prognosis is a lot better.
Yeah.
Cool. Would that be considered black mold? Everyone always talks about black mold.
Stachybotrys, what's termed black mold. Although it's a fairly coarse term. I mean, there are molds that are black that are not Stachybotrys. You have to do the testing to know. So a black color doesn't inherently mean you're in huge trouble.
Yeah, when you were saying that a lot more research should be done on, you know, chronic fatigue syndrome, maybe the connection between mold and chronic fatigue syndrome, it made me...
Right.
I've heard that fungi, you know, in biology, fungi have just been really not well understood. And it's only recently that we've really started to try to classify all the fungi, you know, and we're discovering new species all the time.
Yeah, it's a huge area, really, and there's so much. There's a lot of good stuff that we're finding out about fungi too. Fungi are capable of all kinds of things, and so we should be figuring it out more. There's a researcher who studies the gases that molds emit. And she's discovered two things. So first of all, she discovered that there are mold gases that cause Parkinson's syndrome in fruit flies, or something very much like Parkinson's syndrome in fruit flies, and that also kills human cells. So that is very interesting.
Wow,
they emit these gases called volatile organic compounds. That's what you smell. That's why it smells musty.
See, I thought it was spores that we had to worry about.
Well, it's complicated. So there are a lot of things we have to worry about. And, like, for myself, I don't know what exactly makes me sick. When I say mold, I'm kind of using it as a stand-in word for something associated with water-damaged buildings that makes me sick. So there's the mold itself. There are the spores that the molds throw off, which are kind of like seeds. There's the volatile organic compounds, these gases that we smell that have their own effects. There are also bacteria in water-damaged buildings. The bacteria emit their own toxins. There are particulates. There are volatile organic compounds just from the stuff itself. There's this whole huge brew of stuff. And each of those things, we've got reason to think, can do bad things to us. And in combination, it's probably worse.
Wow, so with the spores, do we have to be concerned about the spores causing fungi to grow in our own bodies?
That can happen. It can happen in particular in sinuses. And people who have chronic sinus infections, it's often fungal. There was the Mayo Clinic did a study of this showing that some very large percentage of chronic sinus infections are actually fungal in nature. And that can be true even if antibiotics seem to help. Antibiotics have a variety of effects beyond just killing bacteria. But repeated courses of antibiotics in the long run can make these infections worse. So chronic sinus infections, like if you are struggling, this is practical advice that really may make a difference for people. If you are struggling with chronic sinus infections, ask your doctor about whether it could be fungal in nature, because there are fungal treatments for sinus infections that can make a huge difference. Most other situations that we know of are either minor, like, you know, fungus in your toenail or something like that, or are things that only happen to people with compromised immune systems. I mean, most situations where fungus is actually growing in your body that we know of are either minor or only for people with compromised immune systems. But it can definitely be very, very serious when it happens. And the exception are sinus infections. That's a pretty common thing that happens to people.
Yeah,
with
well,
infections.
Count me in. I definitely do have chronic sinus infections.
Oh, really? Wow. Yeah, ask your doctor about that. That can make a huge, huge difference if you treat the fungal component of it.
Okay, great. Well, where can people buy your book?
It's on sale now, basically everywhere. You can find it on Amazon, and you can learn more about the book at throughtheshadowlands.com.
Excellent. I really look forward to reading it. Thank you so much, Julie.
Thank you, and good luck with your house.
Thank you.
That was Julie Raymeyer speaking to our reporter, Lincoln Tice, about her new book, Through the Shadowlands, A Science Writer's Odyssey into an Illness that Science Doesn't Understand. It's a fascinating story to be sure, and it certainly makes the case for a link between exposure to toxic mold and some cases of chronic fatigue syndrome. Lincoln was interested in her experience because he has a wet basement problem and has recently hired a contractor to drain and ventilate it and treat the mold. He has struggled with the inflammation for a couple of years and is hopeful that this will help to solve the problem. Check out our website at www.wortfm.org to listen to this segment or any of our past shows on the archive. We are currently in need of volunteers to engineer in the studio or to help produce shows. Please email us at scienceonwort@gmail.com if you are interested in helping out and getting involved in our collective. Today's show was produced by Lincoln Tice and engineered by Dennis Schaefer. I'm your host, Will Cushman.